Welcome to this deep dive, where we unpack pivotal legal cases to give you a clearer understanding of the law. Today, we're diving into People v. Langworthy, a 1982 decision by the Michigan Supreme Court. What makes this case so compelling is the way it grapples with a really fundamental question. When does being under the influence of drugs or alcohol affect, you know, whether you can be held criminally responsible for your actions?
That's right. And it's almost like getting two legal puzzles for the price of one, because this case actually combines the rulings from two separate lower court cases. Wow. We have Langworthy, who is convicted of killing someone after using drugs and alcohol. And then there's Lundy, who was convicted of raping his sister and claimed he was intoxicated at the time. The central issue we're exploring with you is whether the specific intent required for these crimes could have been, well, negated by their voluntary intoxication.
Now, for you, someone diving deep into the intricacies of the law, why should this particular case grab your attention? Well, Langworthy really highlights a cornerstone of criminal law, the crucial distinction between specific and general intent. Understanding how courts interpret statutes to determine which type of intent is required for a crime is absolutely essential. Plus, it throws us right into the messy but vital area of personal responsibility when judgment is impaired. Okay, so let's get down to the core of what happened in these cases.
Sure. In the Langworthy case, the record shows that he had consumed drugs and alcohol before he fatally shot William Wedge.
Yeah.
Langworthy argued that his intoxication meant he couldn't have formed the necessary criminal intent.
Okay.
Separately, Lundy claimed that he was under the influence of alcohol and even glue fumes when he raped his sister. He, too, argued that his intoxicated state should serve as a defense because the crime, in his view, required a specific intent that he couldn't have possessed.
Right. So both are using intoxication as a potential shield.
Exactly.
However, in both cases, the trial courts rejected these arguments. They classified both second-degree murder and first-degree criminal sexual conduct as general intent crimes.
All right, let's really unpack this critical distinction between specific intent and general intent. It's a concept that can sometimes feel a bit abstract, so let's try to make it as clear as possible for you. Specific intent means that when you committed the act, you not only intended to do the physical act itself, but you also had a particular further goal or purpose in mind. Like a classic example, as we mentioned, is intending to kill someone. You pull the trigger with the specific aim of ending their life.
Right.
General intent, on the other hand, simply requires that you intended to do the physical act itself without needing a specific additional purpose.
That's a really clear way to frame it. Think of it like this. Specific intent is maybe using a scalpel with the precise intention of removing a tumor. General intent is more like just swinging a bat. You intend to swing it, but the specific outcome beyond the swing itself might not be your primary focused goal.
Okay, I like that analogy. Or, going back to our earlier analogy, specific intent is aiming for the bullseye, while general intent is just intending to throw the dart towards the board. Now, with that distinction in mind, let's look at how the Michigan Supreme Court applied these definitions to the specific charges in the Langworthy case.
Yeah, here's where the legal reasoning gets particularly interesting. In Langworthy, the Michigan Supreme Court actually agreed with the trial courts. They explicitly stated that under Michigan law, both second-degree murder and first-degree criminal sexual conduct are considered general intent crimes.
And their reasoning for classifying second-degree murder as a general intent crime is quite insightful. The court explained that the element of malice required for a second-degree murder conviction in Michigan doesn't necessarily require a conscious desire to kill someone. Instead, malice can also be established by demonstrating that the defendant acted with a wanton disregard for human life. What's fascinating here is that this means even if Langworthy's judgment was clouded by intoxication, his reckless actions in, you know, using a firearm could still demonstrate this wanton disregard, thus fulfilling the necessary mental state for the crime, even without a specific intent to cause death.
So the recklessness itself can satisfy the intent element, even if he was drunk or high.
According to the court, yes. That wanton disregard is the malice in that context.
And turning our attention to Lundy's case and the charge of first-degree criminal sexual conduct, what was the court's justification for also classifying that as a general intent crime?
For Lundy, the court really focused intently on the precise language used in the Michigan statute that defines criminal sexual conduct. Their interpretation was that the statute criminalizes the act of penetration itself, and crucially, it doesn't include any explicit requirement for a specific intention beyond the commission of that physical act.
So just the intent to do the act of penetration.
Basically, yes. Therefore, even if Lundy's intoxication had impaired his judgment or inhibitions, the fact that he intentionally committed the act of penetration was sufficient to satisfy the intent requirement as defined by the statute. In the court's view, his intoxication, even if significant, didn't negate that fundamental intent to perform the prohibited physical act.
The court also raised a really significant point concerning public policy. What were the underlying societal concerns that seemed to influence their decision?
Absolutely. The court was clearly concerned about the potential ramifications of allowing voluntary intoxication to serve as a broad legal defense, particularly for violent crimes like murder and sexual assault. They worried that such a precedent could inadvertently create a loophole in the law, potentially allowing individuals who commit serious offenses while intoxicated to evade criminal responsibility too easily.
Makes sense.
As the majority opinion clearly stated, and this is a crucial takeaway, voluntary intoxication is not a defense to general intent crimes. They were drawing a firm line, emphasizing the importance of accountability for one's actions, even when those actions occur under the influence of voluntarily consumed substances. This raises an important question, about how society balances individual liberty with the need for public safety and the prevention of harm.
But it's vital to recognize that this wasn't a unanimous decision, right? Justice Levin presented a compelling dissenting argument. What were his key points of disagreement?
Yes, Justice Levin offered a very thoughtful and well-articulated dissenting opinion. He strongly argued that first-degree criminal sexual conduct, in its very nature, does inherently imply a specific intent, namely the conscious intent to achieve sexual penetration.
Okay, so he disagreed fundamentally on the CSC charge.
Right. And similarly, he contended that in the vast majority of murder prosecutions, the prosecution's case overwhelmingly relies on proving either a specific intent to kill or, at the very least, a specific intent to inflict great bodily harm, both of which he argued are clearly specific intents.
So he thought the wanton disregard path was the exception, not the rule.
Precisely. He felt it was hyper-technical, to use his own word, to classify murder as a general intent crime simply because, in some relatively rare and unusual circumstances, a conviction might theoretically be obtained based solely on that legal concept of wanton disregard for human life. Justice Levin's dissent really highlights the inherent difficulty in always drawing a perfectly clear line between what constitutes general versus specific intent. It's often fuzzier than we'd like.
And Justice Coleman, while ultimately siding with the majority and upholding the convictions, seemed to have a slightly different rationale for his concurrence, didn't he?
That's right. While Justice Coleman agreed with the majority's outcome, the convictions stood. His reasoning had a somewhat different emphasis. He concurred that because the specific statutes defining both second-degree murder and first-degree criminal sexual conduct didn't explicitly include a requirement for a specific intent beyond the act itself.
Sticking strictly to the text.
Exactly. The established legal defense of voluntary intoxication, as it was understood at the time, simply didn't apply within the existing statutory framework. However, he offered a note of caution regarding the majority's suggestion that the Michigan legislature should necessarily step in to reform this area of law.
Oh, interesting. Why the caution?
Well, while not necessarily disagreeing that the law could potentially be improved, he argued that the existing framework, as it was being interpreted and applied by the court, was still workable and consistent with fundamental principles of statutory construction. He seemed less inclined to explicitly invite legislative intervention and, potential upheaval of established legal precedent. Kind of a, if it ain't broke, don't fix it vibe, maybe.
So when we step back and look at the bigger picture, what are the key takeaways from People v. Langworthy for someone striving to understand the complexities of criminal law?
Well, first and foremost, this case powerfully illustrates the fundamental importance of statutory interpretation within the legal system. Courts often adhere very closely to the exact wording of the laws when they are tasked with determining the essential elements of a crime. And this absolutely includes the type of criminal intent that the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. You can't just assume intent. You have to find it in the law.
Okay, rule one, read the statute carefully.
Absolutely. Secondly, this case vividly highlights a persistent tension within the law, the ongoing effort to strike a just balance between holding individuals accountable for their actions, even when those actions occur under the influence of intoxicants, and acknowledging the very real and significant impact that intoxication can have on an individual's mental state, judgment, and decision-making processes. This case is a prime example of how legal reasoning attempts to navigate this complex terrain.
And it sounds like the Michigan Supreme Court, or at least the majority of the justices, practically signaled to the Michigan legislature that this might be an area of law ripe for potential legislative review and reform.
Precisely. The majority opinion almost explicitly suggested that if there were to be any significant shifts in how the voluntary intoxication defense is applied in Michigan, particularly in the context of serious violent crimes like the ones before them, those changes should ideally originate from the state legislature through the enactment of new statutes or the amendment of existing ones, rather than through a radical reinterpretation of established legal precedent by the courts.
Right, they prefer the legislature make policy changes.
Generally, yes. So as the court practically hinted, it would be prudent for anyone following Michigan law to pay attention to any potential legislative developments concerning the defense of voluntary intoxication in the future. Until such time, the Langworthy decision remains a clear and binding precedent that dictates how voluntary intoxication is viewed in relation to general intent crimes within that state.
This deep dive into People v. Langworthy really illuminates the intricate ways in which courts wrestle with the complexities of criminal intent and the legal defense of voluntary intoxication. It compels us to consider a fundamental question. How should our legal system best navigate this delicate balance between ensuring personal responsibility for our actions and acknowledging the very real effects that intoxication can have on human behavior and decision-making capabilities?
And as we've seen through the differing viewpoints expressed by the justices of the Michigan Supreme Court themselves, these are not straightforward or simple issues with easy answers. The law in this area is clearly subject to ongoing debate, evolving societal perspectives, and the potential for future legislative changes. This raises a critical question for you to ponder. What are the broader societal implications of either expanding or further restricting the availability of the voluntary intoxication defense in criminal cases? It's a topic with truly significant consequences for how we define crime, responsibility, and accountability within our legal framework and our society as a whole.